CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 97 with Dr. Jack Parker, truly mastering the art of corneal lamellar surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Jack Parker, who has recently put up a video for us on Cataract Coach about a beautiful DMEG procedure, which I was shocked to hear that these are all done in your clinic, in your in-office surgery suite. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Uday.
So for me, I'm no DMEG expert. I learned it by watching videos a few years ago. I used to teach the residents how to do it, but we would always do like in the operating room, a retrobulbar block, and you're making it like a non-issue even. Tell me about your methods.
Well, Uday, probably the greatest fortune in my life has been to be around so many brilliant, generous people who just out of the kindness of their own heart have just been willing to teach me things. And, you know, probably foremost among those is my dad. You know, our practice is myself and my father. He is a cornea specialist. He's my best friend. He's my hero. And growing up, I just wanted to be just like dad. And another real formative figure for me in my life has been this Dutch ophthalmologist named Garrett Mellis. And I heard about Garrett from my dad, because when I was a medical student at UAB, in a part of our graduating requirements, we had to complete some research project. And, you know, I never had any interest in research whatsoever. I'd just done the bare minimum necessary to put on your resume when applying for medical school. And so naturally, I thought, well, as part of completing this research requirement, I'll just do it with Dad. And Dad said, no, I don't have any research. You can't do anything with me. But if you want to really make something out of this, you might as well think about contacting this Dutch guy, Garrett Mellis, who has invented these lamellar transplants. And I didn't know anything about Garrett. I didn't know anything about cornea, but I figured, okay, well, you know, he's from Holland and maybe I'll get a 2-month-long vacation out of the experience. So I just looked up Garrett Mellis's email address online and just sent him an email on Gmail. And out of the just kindness of his heart, he invited me over to Holland to spend 2 months with him working in his facility. And those 2 months over there in Holland accidentally ended up turning into 10 years. I accidentally ended up staying over there for 10 years and working with him and doing a PhD in the subject of his innovations in anterior and posterior lamellar keratoplasty. Wow. And the reason I tell this extremely long story to answer your very simple question is because when I went over there, not knowing anything about the eye or ophthalmology, I mean, just a third year medical student, Garrett was doing all of these surgeries, which were brand new at the time, in his office. He was doing DMEC and DSEC in the office. And the reason is that his genius at the time had not been, I think, adequately recognized. He had all of these brilliant surgical techniques that he had pioneered. His previous position at the University of Amsterdam, at the hospital there, as far as I understand, they said, well, what are these new techniques? You know, I mean, we don't know about all these surgeries. PK was the standard, of course, right, at the time. And so in order to be able to devise these operations and make them work and to work on them, he had to do them basically in his office. And to facilitate that, those office-based surgeries, not only did he develop all of the techniques, but he also built this device called the Surgicube, which is, I think, quite popular in Europe, although somewhat unknown in the United States. It's a modular laminar downflow hood that provides sterile air immediately around the operating site. So you can think back to when you were like in chemistry undergrad and you had that lab and you were pipetting under the hood. Well, right. Garrett pulled one of those out from the wall basically and mounted it on stilts, and you can operate underneath it. And the advantage of doing that is that if you have a particle counter underneath that hood, you'll find that it is zero particulate matter floating around. So it is cleaner than a conventional OR. It's cleaner than the room they build the space station in. But at the same time, you can put it in any old room. You don't have to have a big down flow system coming from the ceiling. You don't have to be in, a hospital or even an ASC. So it allows you to provide very, very clean surgeries in a very mundane environment. So the point of this is that, you know, office-based surgery is something we do now, but and maybe it sounds a little radical, but it's 20 years old, and it was invented by Garrett, and it's how DMEC and DSEC started their life. So it's actually as traditional and old and historic as the whole surgery is doing it in the office.
I had no idea. Now, you spent 10 years then in Amsterdam?
Yes, it was a little bit piecemeal back and forth, which was incredible because I just had this unbelievably generous system. You know, UAB, which is where I went to medical school and residency, the people there were so nice to me because they knew what a big deal Garrett was, and they did everything they could to try to help me continue an interaction with him. So when I went to UAB for residency, our program director, Russ Reed, who treated me way better than I deserve in a million different ways, he adjusted the residency to allow me to spend some time in Holland during the residency, which is just, I mean, I can't even imagine how, I mean, right. It's so nice of him, you know, but it was just this incredibly fortunate thing that I managed to spend doing, which changed the whole course of my life. Just as an accident, just because Dad wouldn't let me do a research project with him, basically.
That's funny how that works out. So take me through this. So you finish high school, you do an undergraduate bachelor's degree somewhere.
Yes, at University of Alabama.
So, okay, you're a local guy then. And then after you finish that, you start med school, and then you go in the middle of med school, you go to Holland for 10 years?
Well, I was in Holland for sort of a few months there, a few months back, you know, because there are these visa requirements and so forth all through third year and fourth year, and then internship, and then through residency. And it's kind of this amazing act of fortune because, you know, I would never have gone to Holland in the first place, except for the fact that UAB had this opportunity to do the research project, you know, which I think was a little bit unique to UAB at the time, at least the medical school. I'm not sure how the curriculums are now, but you know, pretty much every major defining role or part of my education has come through happy accident of failing to achieve something that I was going for. You know, when I was applying for college out of high school, I was a real big participant on the debate team. Debate was my whole life. You know, I loved debate. And the best debate program at the time in the country was Dartmouth. And I applied for Dartmouth and I didn't get in. So I went to Alabama, and that's probably why I ended up becoming a doctor, was because I didn't get into Dartmouth. And when I was applying for medical school, the school I really wanted to go to was Hopkins, and I applied for it and didn't get in. And it's probably because I didn't get in that I met Garrett Mellis. And then it's the same way for residency. You know, it's every step of the way, it's kind of been these happy failures that have resulted in some of the best parts of my life anyway.
Yeah, sometimes that stuff just cannot be planned. You just got to take life as it comes, and you just roll with it, and it often turns out better than you had planned.
Right, exactly.
Wow, fantastic. So you finish your residency, and then you what do you do after? More research, more Holland time?
So I went back to Holland for a year, and I did a fellowship also back in the United States with my father. And the reason I wanted to do that is because Dad and I are best friends. But if you've ever been roommates with your best friend, you know, sometimes that's not as good of an idea as it sounds. And so I thought, well, let's try a year with Dad and see how that works out and see if we get along and work together. And if we don't, then I'll have taken the knowledge that I've gotten from him and I can go apply it to somewhere else. And if it does work out, then it'd be a great opportunity for us then to start working together on a more permanent basis. And it was just amazing. It was great, you know. So I came back and did a year in Holland, a year with Dad. And then from then on, I've just been working with Dad in Birmingham, doing mostly complicated corneal transplant operations. That's a little bit unique about our practice, is that we tend to focus on the most complex issues. And again, I think a lesson that we learned from Garrett is, at least philosophically, we try to do those things that otherwise couldn't be done or wouldn't be done. And it's not just because those are the most fun things for us to do. Just personally, selfishly, those are the things that I find myself most interested in. But it's also a little bit of, for us, it's been kind of a happy business move. There's this entrepreneur over in California with you, Uday, Peter Thiel, and he wrote this book called Zero to One, and it's about sort of business philosophy. And one of the key tenets of the book, he says, is that competition is for losers. And it's not just because, well, there can only be one winner and everybody else is second or third, and if you're not first, you're last. It's that even if you come out on top, even if you're number one, it's often by the skin of your teeth and you're fighting and scraping against other people who are looking to depose you any moment, you know? Whereas if you're doing something completely and utterly other, if you're working on something that other people don't do or won't do or can't do, you're a little bit more insulated from those pressures, from the pressure of rampant competition. And so weirdly, by focusing our practice on the worst cases, the most miserable operations, it turns out that we're very busy. We're able to do a lot of surgeries and see a lot of patients. And at the same time, we feel like not only are we not competing against other people, but people who would conventionally be our biggest competition, other general ophthalmologists or even other cornea surgeons, tend to be our biggest referral sources. Because since we do so many of those cases, we have a little bit of an economy of scale, and we're a little bit more a member of the team as opposed to someone else holding a knife, if that makes sense.
No, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, even the case you sent me that we featured was, patient had multiple prior surgeries, vitrectomy, I guess cataract surgery that went south, had a Yamane, slowly fixated IOL, had an artificial iris, and now it's time for you to fix the PBK.
Well, just because we have done so many of those cases, you know, you get a little bit more of a rhythm or a routine doing some of these corneal transplant operations. So in a normal week, we do, I think, probably between, I myself personally do between 20 and 25 transplant operations a week, always in the office. Yeah, always in the office under topical anesthesia, just with oral Valium. And of these corneal transplant surgeries, because we try to do not just transplants, but the more difficult transplants, usually these are eyes with tube shunts that are post-vitrectomy, that have had complicated surgery, that have had an ACIOL. And so very many of these are combined with something like a scleral fixated IOL, you know, a glued IOL or something like this. So there are multiply complicated operations. But just because you do them all the time, it's all day, every day, you get a little bit of an efficiency in doing them. And so a case like that is normally a 10-minute surgery for us. You know, you can do a corneal transplant under topical anesthesia in 10 minutes. And we have, in our office-based operating environment, we have two rooms. So I just bounce back and forth between the two rooms, and we'll do four or five transplants an hour in the two rooms in the office.
That's amazing.
And it's not just me. It's not just, well, I've done lots of cases and so I'm more efficient. It's because we do our cases in the office, the people who assist me are the scribe, the scribes that I use, the technicians who work up the patient, our front and desk workers in the clinic. They come back and they help in surgery with pre and post-op and that sort of thing. And so everybody in our clinic is intimately familiar with these patients during the surgery process. The scribe knows exactly what instruments we need when she is now the circulator or the scrub tech, because she saw that patient in the clinic and she knows who that person is and she knows their history. And it's a lot more comfortable for the patients because it's people that you recognize. But because it's not just random people at the hospital who are taking breaks and scrubbing in and scrubbing out, it's people who already know the patient and do the same surgery every day, all day, every week. There's just this incredible teamwork efficiency built into doing surgeries in the office. And that surprised me. You know, when we started office-based surgery, I thought, I don't know about this. You know, I mean, is this really going to be safe? Right. Is this really going to be, But it turns out that it's not just possible. I think it is safer. I think it is better to do it in the office because it's all your instruments. It's all your staff. It's your protocol. It's your time schedule. It's you control everything to so much of a higher degree than when you are checking into a hospital and nobody works for you and you don't make the rules and you're just trying not to get in trouble yourself. You know, when you are sort of running the show, so to speak, I find that things are a lot more logical, and they come together in a way that tends to produce better outcomes, at least in my opinion.
Wow, it makes me feel like I should be doing cataracts then. I mean, a cataract to me is much simpler surgery, much easier than a complex DMEC.
Well, you know, Uday, I don't know about that. I really think that probably cataracts are, we do cataracts in the office too. We do cataract surgery in the office. But, you know, with cataract surgery, the best cataract surgeons I am in awe of, you know, I watch Cataract Coach every day and I try to take notes on what I can do to do my cataract surgeries better. Because when cataract surgery goes wrong, it can be a disaster. You've got vitreous, you got missing lens fragments everywhere. You know, I mean, the pupil is could be a mess. I mean, refractive surprise. I mean, there are all of these things with cataract surgery that still give me, you know, the chills sometimes. With DMEC, everything is up above the iris plane. You know, the pupil is constricted, you know. I mean, there's usually no vitreous. There are no lens fragments you're having to tangle with. There are no refractive expectations to manage. You know, when I'm doing a phaco DMEC and the phaco is over, I always think, okay, great. The hard part of the surgery is done, and now we can do it as straightforward. I'm being dead serious, you know.
I think the opposite.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting. In college, I was never, you know, the A number one student, you know, the person that could just show up cold and just ace a test. That was never me. But I do remember organic chemistry. I walked into organic chemistry and I thought, okay, this is like the hardest thing. This is going to be, you know, the real test of my mettle. And I remember thinking it was just like any other normal pre-med class. I just thought it was basically standard. But, you know, it has this reputation, in my opinion, because it's to everybody's benefit. You know, if you take the class and you don't do so well, well, it's okay, because that's the very hardest class. And if you take the class and you do great, well, you are a genius. I think DMEC is the same way. It's just a normal surgery. It makes, you know, it the reputation that it's some really, really challenging, difficult operation kind of serves everybody, because it makes you look like a genius when it goes well, and it makes you look like it's okay when it doesn't go so well. The one exception I would say to that is that, you know, I think that DMEC is less algorithmic in some ways than other operations. Like, for example, complicated cataract surgery. I mean, you can have a really complicated case with a rock hard lens, with missing zonules and iris problems and vitreous in the AC, and you can have a panel discussion about what to do. And it's not that everybody will agree, but there are well-established protocols for what to do. Okay, you put the viscoelastic in the eye, you stay in the capsule with TriPen Blue. If the capsule starts to run out, then you do the little maneuver. Whereas with something like a DMEC, for example, you inject the graft into the anterior chamber, and then if you pause the video and you ask a panel of corneal surgeons, what do you do next? Everybody kind of just shrugs and looks around and says, well, I guess tap on the eye a little bit, you know. Right. And there's not really anything to do. There's not a thing you can tell someone to do. And so it is a little bit more vague how to proceed. And yeah, also, theoretically, it's problem solving on a timer because the stain is fading. And so even though it's not a difficult problem, people don't like problem solving on a timer. They'd rather handle a more challenging thing than a weird new thing with a timer going. And I right. think that may be why the extra reputation of difficulty abides.
Well, it's also the origami folding.
Yeah, true.
The graph that goes in there to understand how to unfold the graph. For you, when I watch your video, it's like second nature, tap, 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 done, put a bubble in, see ya. But for when you're first starting off, and remember a few years ago, I started like case one, here's how I'm going to learn, by watching other people's videos. It took me a while to understand the origami. And I think there was a video from Peter Veldman from Chicago, which was just beautiful, because it finally, at my level, which is not that smart, explaining like, here's how you, this orientation of the graph, do this maneuver. This way, do that maneuver. And that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not magic. It's basically physics or fluid dynamics. And I'm no physicist, but it's not just like, well, you tap and pray. It's like these are mechanical things that you are doing to the eye, which right. do have a predictable effect. And it's just like you said, actually, the best way to learn those things is by watching videos. And in my opinion, the best videos to watch are your own videos, because, you know, it's like if you've ever given a lecture and someone comes up and asks you, they say, guess what, Uday, I've got great news. I tape recorded your lecture. Would you like to listen to yourself? I think everybody says, no, sure. Definitely no, I not. I don't. Because you know that if you listen to your own lecture, you're going to say, oh, well, I was saying a million times. I was rambling and making no sense. I was waving my hand like a crazy person the whole time. And you know those things are on tape. And that's why you don't want to watch it, because you don't want to have that brought to your conscious awareness. It's the exact same thing with your own surgical videos. You know, you turn on your surgical video and you say, 28 minutes? What the heck was I doing for 28 minutes, you know? And then it's just sort of like you realize how much fumbling and dead air there is during your operation. And you're not going to realize that. You're not going to see those mistakes by watching someone else operate. You have to watch yourself operate to pick those up. And with DMEC, you know, it's you do something, you know, you tap on the cornea or you put some fluid inside of the eye and you think, well, did the graft do what I thought it would do? Yes or no. And if it didn't do that thing, that means your understanding of what is happening is wrong. Your understanding of what's going on in the eye at that moment is incorrect. And in my opinion, your level of mastery is basically predicted by whether or not you can call your shot, which is to say, if I tap here, the graft will do this thing. Or if I put fluid in the eye right here now, this is what's going to happen. And the only way you get that is by watching your video, making a prediction, playing the video and seeing what happened, and then writing down and tabulating those cause and effect relationships. And I think it should, in theory, be very predictable, but the only way you get it is by watching your own videos and by stopping and asking yourself the question, what do I think is about to happen?
That makes a ton of sense. I mean, you've got to watch your game day footage, no question about it. But here's another simpler analogy. So it's like me learning basketball. I've never played in my life, let's say. So let me learn. This is a free throw. This is a three-point shot. This is a layup. And so in this situation, let me do a layup. In this situation, whereas you're just playing pick-up ball. You're just good. You don't even think about it. You just do whatever you got to do. But a newbie who's starting off, I have to see Veldman's video of like, okay, this maneuver for this folding, this. And then I put it together. And then as I did more and more, as I did, let's say, 10 of them, I just kind of knew. Like, I don't have to think about it anymore. I could just do it. But you're doing 1,000 DMX or corneal surgeries a year.
Yeah,
I won't do 1,000 in my lifetime.
Well, but, you know, the thing is that we're not doing so many cataract surgeries, for example. I mean, that's what we do, you know? I mean, it's corneal transplants, another complicated operation. So my normal surgery day is on a Thursday. So just yesterday we did I think 18 corneal transplants in the office. And I did 3 glued IOLs, so 3 scleral fixated IOLs with a glued technique in the office yesterday. And so it's even really complicated cases can be done in the office. It's not just sort of the standard corneal transplants. But again, it's just because you get proficient at the things you do all the time, so long as you have sort of made that your mission to focus on. And then you go back and watch the tape and say, well, why did that not go the way that I thought it would go? Or what could be better? You know, and it's like you said, the game day footage, you know, if you watch NFL or the, you know, football games, you know, on the side, it's not just like, well, on Monday morning, you have the quarterback watching the footage. It's like when he goes to the sideline, when his turn is done, he sits on the bench and then immediately pulls out the iPad and is watching the last play, you know? And that's the standard. I mean, at all high levels of human physical performance, people are watching the tape. And if you're not watching the tape, it's, well, what makes you so great? How come Tom Brady has to do it and you don't?
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. So in your surgery center, I mean, your office-based setup, so if you're doing, let's say, the glued lens, so scleral fixated IOL, you're still doing just topical, or are you doing some subconj, and it's only oral Valium, 5-10 milligrams? What are we doing here?
We usually offer patients a choice between nothing, 5 or 10 milligrams of oral Valium. The most anxious, apprehensive patients by far select no Valium. That's what they all choose. And the reason is that they're too anxious to take the Valium. They're worried about being drugged out. So it is very common we will operate on a very apprehensive patient who opts for no Valium. But if we're doing an operation that involves sort of deeper incisions into the eye, like, for example, to remove an ACIOL and then do a glued technique, then almost always we supplement those patients with some subtenons, bupivacaine. My preferred formulation of that, there's this medicine called Exparel, which is not new. It's been around for 10 years at least. And it's used very commonly in orthopedic operations. So Exparel is bupivacaine, but it's bound up in liposomal micelles. And what that means is that the normal subtenons or retrobulbar lidocaine has a duration of action of 4 to 6 hours, but liposomal bupivacaine, this Exparel, has a duration of action of 72 hours. So it actually keeps the eye blocked for 3 days. And that is a really nice thing because it provides really good, durable anesthesia, not just during the operation, but during the first few post-operative days when the eye is normally the most uncomfortable. And you can use that in as a subtenons block during surgery. We also give it for our patients who are undergoing cross-linking these days, because cross-linking involves creating a 9 millimeter corneal epithelial defect and then irradiating the cornea. And so you can numb the eye for those 3 days while the eye is re-epithelializing. It makes them much more comfortable. So that's something that we've incorporated in the last couple of years, adding Exparel to our pre-operative anesthesia regimen.
Well, that's so interesting. I didn't even, never even heard of it. I obviously heard of bupivacaine or marcaine, but this is, I guess, putting in micelles. So it has a longer half-life.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same maneuver. You think, okay, well, it's a different solution and it just seems to work better. So great.
Wow, that's a neat idea. Yeah, I think we're going to move towards that in the future. I think you'll see more and more of these office-based procedures being performed. These big surgeries that were once in surgery centers are probably going to shift to more office-based.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, I mean, so much of it is bound up in these insurance considerations. You know, I think that's probably the dirty secret of most of medicine, is that so much of care is being decided on the basis of not what is objectively in the patient's best interest, but rather what is insurance permissible. You know, operating in a hospital is so expensive. It's so expensive and it's so time consuming. You know, I mean, we are lucky enough in Birmingham, Alabama to have a 7-story eye hospital. That's all it does is eyes, you know, and there are two floors of ORs where they just do eyes. I mean, that's a real rarity. And yet it's about one case per hour. It's about one case per hour to operate in an eye hospital. And so if you're going to be doing, you know, if you're going to get really good at something, you have to do a lot of it, in my opinion. I mean, maybe you have some savants, but I mean, that's not me. You know, in order for me to get good at something, I have to do a lot of it. And it's tough to do a lot of it if you're doing one case an hour at the eye hospital, you know. So in order to really get good, you've got to do a higher volume, which means you have to move those cases out of the hospital. So an ASC, I think, is one logical alternative. That's probably where lots of people who are high volume do their cases. And ASC is, I know, we're really opposed at the beginning. They're not safe. They're not regulated like a hospital. Patients will be harmed. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding. I think the results from an ASC are at least as good at a hospital, you know.
If not better.
I haven't seen any data to contradict that. And this is a projection into the future, but I just don't think that the office space is going to be different.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. Now, do you offer then for patients, fly in on Wednesday, see them in clinic Wednesday afternoon, surgery on Thursday, check them Friday morning, and Friday they can fly home?
Yes, that's what we do. We do that very, very often. And we kind of have to do that because, you know, if we are trying to collect people with complicated issues, you know, we had a patient 2 weeks ago who flew in from Canada who had a history of multiple retinal detachments, who currently had an eye filled with silicone oil, who flew in on Wednesday for DMEC on Thursday. And if you're going to be able to attract people from far away, you can't tell them, well, you're going to enjoy Birmingham for the next 2 months that you're living here. You know, you have to be able to fix them and send them home, basically, you know?
No, that makes a ton of sense here. Now, how do you do the billing then for Medicare, for the facility fee and anesthesia, whatever? How do you do all that?
It has been I wouldn't say surprisingly easy. There have been challenges, but it's been surprisingly possible. So for commercial insurances, like, for example, Blue Cross, our official designation is a single specialty, or excuse me, single surgeon ASC. That's different than single specialty. Single surgeon ASC is a different designation. So we have no trouble whatsoever from commercial entities. Even things like Medicare, for example, we're still able to do those operations. Now, we don't receive any additional payment. So we get paid the same amount for doing an operation on a patient with Medicare in our office as compared to if we did them in the hospital. And then we have to eat the cost of producing that surgery. For us to produce a DMEC surgery, it probably costs us about $90 in terms of cannulas and BSS and drapes and gloves and that sort of thing. Our cost is about $90. So you might say, well, you're losing $90 per case then. And that's true. Yes, that's correct. But I can do 5 an hour in the office, whereas I do 1 an hour at the eye hospital. And so we make it up basically in terms of the number of patients we're able to do.
And no issues then with the graft being reimbursed? Because that's the expensive tissue, right? That's the big issue.
Shockingly, no. And when we started, we were very worried about that because we thought, well, the tissue costs us about $6,000 a pop. And if I'm doing 20 a week, we're going to be writing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of checks before we know if we're going to get any payment back. Wow. So I don't know that we started necessarily doing 20 a week, you know, when we started tiptoeing into it, you know, but we were very concerned with it. Are we ever going to see any of this money back? So it was a big gamble, it was a big risk, but it has turned out to be, you know, it's turned out to work fine for us.
Now you order the grafts then already good to go. Cut the way you like it, stained, stamped, in the injector, ready to go.
For a long time, I was preparing them myself. And there are some really good cornea specialists. For example, I think famously Frank Price still prepares all the grafts himself that morning before the surgery. And he's very high volume, amazing DMEC surgeon. One advantage of preparing them yourself is you can size them on the operating room table. And that's something I think is really important, that you can size the grafts for the patient. Some patients need a big graft. Some people need a small graft. And it is related to the character of the eye, not just the white to white of the cornea, but also the depth of the chamber and the relevant various pathologies that appertain as well. So I used to measure the patients with calipers on the operating room table and then punch the graft myself. But that does take a long time. What we've started doing instead is requesting grafts of a specified diameter be delivered to us already stained, already punched, already loaded in an injector. But we ask them to be prepared according to certain criteria. You know, as opposed to a stamp, we usually prefer what's called a shark fin mark, which is a triangular cutout at the edge of the graft, which tends to point in a clockwise direction when the graft is right side up. That's probably more visible and less injurious to the tissue than ink marks, which can bleed and become a little bit indistinct. The other thing we specify is the age of the donor. For more complicated eyes, we typically like to use older donors, which are easier to unfold. And then also graft size. You know, now we have very tight specifications for different graft sizes, depending on what's going on in the eye. So just yesterday, for example, we used a 6.5 millimeter DMEC graft on an eye that was previously vitrectomized. It had a Yamani fixated IOL that was also post failed PK. And if you're doing a DMEC on an eye that's had a PK, you have to have a small diameter graft to fit inside the PK so it doesn't detach. So we will request 5 millimeter grafts or 5.5 millimeter or 6 millimeter grafts all the time. And it's nice not to have to collect those punches yourself and do it, to have somebody else do them for you and send it for you ready to go.
And at the end of the procedure, you're just doing filtered room air in the eye. You're not using any special gas.
Not even filtered. We don't even use filtered air. We just aspirate it from the atmosphere and then inject it into the eye. And then once that is injected into the eye, we sit the patient up and just have them walk off the operating room table. So we have no supine posturing whatsoever. Yeah, no positioning at all. And it's just room air. And the reason why we use air as opposed to gas is, I think, basically twofold. The first is that's what Garrett Mellis does. And I think that, you know, he's the best in the world at this procedure. He was the smartest. He invented it. And if it's good enough for Garrett, it's probably good enough for us. You know, So that's like the glib answer for why. Okay. The second reason why we use air as opposed to gas is because I think that what really matters is having a good, firm air fill right after the surgery. A good, full, a firm air fill immediately postoperatively, I think, is important. But having a 30% air bubble in the eye, I think, does nothing. I don't think that helps at all, okay? Having an 80% bubble or 90% bubble, that is doing something. A 30% bubble does nothing. So if you have SF6 floating around in the eye for a couple of weeks, is that helping anybody? I don't think so. I don't think so. And the other thing that convinces me of that is, you know, we do lots of patients who are unicameral, and you see them one day post-op, and maybe they have a tube shunt, or maybe they've been post-vitrectomized, and they have no air in the anterior chamber whatsoever, or they have a 5% bubble or something like that. You know, it's they're not getting any enduring support. And those patients don't have higher detachment rates than the patients who've got a 60%. They've got the same detachment rate or less. So I don't think having air in the eye for a couple of days does anything. I think you just want it right after the surgery. For a couple of hours is probably the maximum benefit you get. And air seems fine for that.
And a good firm fill, I guess.
If the eye is hypotenuse, the graft won't stick. But if the eye is a normal physiologic pressure with an 80% bubble, I think that's as good as, doesn't matter what the gas composition is, in my opinion.
And then that endothelial pump function takes over and the graft is just, now it's adherent and you're good to go, basically. So even like in your vitrectomized unicameral eyes where the bubble may migrate back in the vitreous cavity, they still look fine.
Yeah, I think so. And that's been shocking. You know, it's kind of like the organic chemistry discussion we just had. You know, people are think, okay, well, DMEC and a Fuchs eye, that's hard enough as it is. Why in the world would I try to an eye that has a tube shunt or that's been post-vitrectomized or has iris abnormalities? Those eyes are not really any more difficult. People like to think that they're more difficult, right? Because it gives you an excuse regardless of what happens, good or bad. But it's just more or less the normal same stuff for the vast majority of patients.
So in your practice, I mean, it's 90% cornea. You do, so you'll do like many times more corneal surgeries than, let's say, routine cataracts.
Yeah, definitely. So in a normal week, we probably do two or three routine cataracts and, you know, 20 transplants and a handful of glued lenses and that sort of thing, you know. But it's very few just normal run-of-the-mill cataracts. And one of the reason for that is that our practice, you know, we have a main location where I sleep, you know, basically in Birmingham, Alabama. But we have these satellite offices that are scattered around Alabama and then also now in Mississippi, a surrounding state, with probably some more plans for some of the other surrounding states. And it's just me and Dad as the provider. Okay. So we don't have this big network of doctors or optometrists or other cornea specialists. We don't have a fellow. It's just me and him. And so we will travel to these satellite offices once a month or twice a month or so, and we will see huge number of patients, but none of them are referred for dry eye or, right, you know, allergic or rosacea. You know, they're all surgical referrals. And many of the surgical referrals that we get are from general ophthalmologists and, in fact, cataract surgeons. And the cataract surgeons love us to come to these satellite offices. And they're our best referring doctors because the average cornea specialist wants to do as many cataracts as possible with a few little corneas on the side. And so the typical cornea specialist is a competitor to the general ophthalmologist. Yeah. Whereas not only are we not competing with the general ophthalmologist, we refer cataract patients to the general ophthalmologist so that they're glad that we are there. Right. So we tend to try to refer more cataracts than we do. You know, every once in a while, you more or less have to do one or so, but we try to refer more than we do, which makes us sort of a better teammate and member of the community than if we try to go everywhere and do everything and compete with everybody for everything.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you're ultra, ultra specialized. I mean, your practice is Parker cornea.
Yeah, not indeed. Parker cornea. Right.
Like,
We try to go to as many optometric and ophthalmological meetings as we can in the area and the surrounding states or so. And it just so happens that we have sort of accumulated this nickname over the years that I was unaware of up until recently. But evidently, they call us the trash men, okay, or the garbage men, because that's kind of what our practice is based on, is doing the really tough stuff that comes from all over.
Well, it sounds like you love it. You know, the best part is you love it. You got a passion for it.
Right. You know, maybe it's just my own ADD or something like that. But for me, it just makes every day a little bit exciting. You know, it's like when you go in with this mild sense of trepidation every right. surgical day that you think, well, you know, this might be the day that it just all comes crashing down. This may be the time that I've bit off more than I can chew. You know, it animates you a little bit in a way, at least for me, that makes me feel a little bit more energetic than think, okay, well, I just got to keep my head down and slog out these 50 cases that are just, you know, the same thing as whatever. For me, it makes it more fun.
Right, because you kind of never know what you're going to get. There's a lot of variety in these cases and a little bit of, like you said, unpredictability. It's a little bit of trepidation. And so, yeah, that makes it fun and exciting. It's like you don't want to play the same video game if you've already mastered it. Now it's boring.
Right.
It still feels a little bit of a challenge to you and you kind of don't know what to expect. You keep playing the game.
Exactly. If you're not, you know, I think that I'm not a downhill skier, but I remember someone telling me that you want to feel like when you're skiing that you're about 80% in control, okay? And there's that little 20% that you're kind of pushing. And I don't know if I exactly say I feel like I'm out of control in surgery, but you always, at least for me, I really want to feel like I'm pushing a little bit to try to see what's possible, what can we do, what can we accomplish, just to push things a little bit to the next level or so.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, it sounds like a neat practice. I mean, I'm going to have to come visit. I have to check this out.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you mentioned that. You know, I mean, the first thing I mentioned when we started this conversation is that, I mean, basically all the formative experiences of my life have come from individual people teaching me things. And, you know, I've gone to visit lots and lots. I try to visit people all the time because, you know, meetings are fine and great. You know, you can read books, you can read articles online, you can watch videos. But if you know, you fly out somewhere and you meet with somebody, it's shocking what people will just teach you, what they will tell you, you know? I mean, I remember my dad told me a long time ago, he said, you know, who's the most famous athlete in the world? Michael Jordan or, you know, Tom Brady? It's like, are you ever going to talk to them? No. And if you do, it's for 2 seconds and they don't want to talk to you. And it's just like a chance encounter or whatever, you know? And what they do is great. It's fine. Okay. But you think about the most famous ophthalmologists in the world, people with every bit as much incredible ability and talent, you know? I mean, like Uday, you, Amar Agrawal, Ed Holland, I mean, yeah. Susan Jacob, Garrett Mellis, you can email them today. You can talk to them on the phone today. And I mean, that is amazing. You can talk to people who are at the tip top of their field and have a relationship with them and be mentored by them. And what does it cost? It's free. You know, yeah. I mean, that's like, I mean, to get private basketball lessons from Michael Jordan. Okay. Can I fly to your house tomorrow? Yes. For free.
Sure.
I mean, like, and so I try to go, last year I went to, spend time with Carol Shields up in Philadelphia. I mean, it's like it's amazing. It's mind blowing. I went and spent 2 days with Bob Osher and Mike Snyder a few years ago. Changed my life. I mean,
amazing.
It's like it's amazing. More people don't take advantage of that because you will learn more in one day with the person who's the very best at what they do than you will learn in 5 years getting your badge stamped at the AAO or something.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. No. For sure. Absolutely, for sure. Now, you mentioned Osher, who's for me is my guru. He's the godfather of all ophthalmic surgical videos. And how did you write a book with him? So if people don't know, there's a great book that you wrote with Osher called What I Say. Tell me about that. That's an amazing book.
Well, it wasn't my idea. What happened was when I was a fellow, I went to his conference that he ran at the time called Cataract Surgery, Telling It Like It Is. And he had this panel discussion, which he had for a long time, I think, you know, it was my first time going. And it was about how to discuss various difficult situations with patients. And one difficult conversation that I had been struggling with at the time was how to talk to patients about toric lenses, okay? And I was very unsure about what to say, okay? Because normally what I would say is, well, Miss Jones, you're interested in getting rid of your glasses, right? But actually, hold on just a second, because I'm not talking about reading glasses. You will be wearing those all the time. And I can't actually promise you that you won't be wearing your glasses. And you're certainly not getting your money back if you are wearing your glasses after the surgery. But maybe we might be able to reduce the possibility statistically of you wearing some glasses for some circumstances. How would you like to pay for a toric lens? Okay. And obviously that's not convincing anybody of anything. And you feel like such a moron trying to explain that to somebody. I wouldn't. I'd see somebody who had visually significant astigmatism. And because I was so apprehensive about giving them that stupid, bad sales pitch to ask for cash out of their pocket, I wouldn't. And so everybody was worse off because I didn't mention it to the patient. Right. They ended up with worse vision and the practice ended up with less revenue. So it was the worst possible outcome. Okay. And then I heard Osher give this talk. And what he says is what he does for his toric lenses patients is he holds up the topography and he shows them the usually red abnormality on their map. You see this, Miss Jones? This should be green. Before you're even done talking, she knows that red ain't the same. Red is the opposite of green. And before you're even done with the sentence, she's asking herself, what can I do to treat the red? Okay. And so Osher says, well, we have a lens that is useful for correcting astigmatism, which will improve the quality of your vision. Are you interested? Yes. Okay. And the patients are begging for the toric lens, and there are no unfulfilled promises about, well, you said no glasses, or, you know, I mean, it's simple, it's memorable, it's true. And when I heard him say that, I thought, this is incredible. Okay. So after his talk, I went up and asked him, I said, I would like to come spend time with you in Cincinnati, not, you know, watching you treat patients in clinic, not in surgery, I mean, but just listening to you explain things to people. And if you've ever talked to Osher, you know, he's this masterful, you know, I mean, he's got this incredible way with words, which is very unique. And so when I spent time with him in Cincinnati and I was taking notes the whole time, and I said, okay, I'm going to write all this stuff down and this needs to be a book. Okay. Do you want to help with this or not? Okay, because I'm going to publish these things that you have said. And he said, well, yes, we can make this into a book, but the only condition is it can't just be my words. We have to get other people involved also. Right. So he calls his friends, which are, I mean, everybody, David Chang and Mike Snyder, I mean, the people that are just household names. And everybody wrote just a little paragraph. You know, Sam Maskett, when I emailed him, he wrote back in all caps. He said, my firm rule is no book chapters ever again, but I will make an exception for Bob Osher. Okay. And so it's like what David Chang tells patients when he drops a nuclear fragment into the back of the eye. That's right. What's in the book, you know, not how to manage a nuclear, which everybody has seen 1,000 videos on. But when you have to go shuffle into the waiting room and talk to the patient's family who've been waiting there for an hour and they thought it was a 5-minute surgery, what are the words that should come out of your mouth, you know? And that's something that I was never really taught in residency. You know, people say, well, be honest. Well, okay, but you know, you got to say something. What should you say? You know, I mean, there's words that you can say that are better or worse than others. And what I used to do was I would have something bad happen and I would be very upset about it. And then I would immediately leave the OR very upset. And then I would go meet the patient's family very upset and stammer out something. And that is not the best way to deal with that situation. What to say ahead of it, before you're emotionally activated and upset, to have a plan. Is that so ridiculous to just have a plan? So that's why this book exists, is so you have a plan for what to say, not just for post-operative complications, but for pre-operative stuff. You know, you've got somebody who's got pseudoexfoliation syndrome. Are you telling them about dandruff on the zonules? I mean, is just a waste of your breath? Or what do you say to tell the patient to prepare them without scaring them? What do you say? You know, and that's what this book is about.
Yeah, and it's called what I say. Yeah. Okay, I got a copy here somewhere on my shelf. I should pull it out. I did a review actually on Cataract Coach of it. A couple years ago.
My contribution is very, very minimal. It was just the insistence that this book had to be written, and we had to write down the words of people that are venerated. It's Bob Osher, and I mean, people that everybody knows and trusts. Everybody has problems. Everyone has difficult things. What do they say? It was very helpful for me just to learn that myself, you know? And so it's amazing to be a part of a project like that.
Yeah, I read the book cover to cover. 20 years into my practice. At the age of 50, I learned a lot. I bookmarked a few pages, told dog-eared corners, like, okay, let me remember this one. This is really good. It's just a great book. I can't recommend it enough. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
So what other projects you got going on? You've got a whirlwind here of fun projects.
Well, you know, it's like there's always something interesting to focus on or do, you know, when you have a practice that's basically the weird outlier stuff. Sure. You know, we have been inspired by you, Uday, to have a little bit of a YouTube channel. The YouTube channel that we have has got nowhere near the breadth of subject matter. It's got nowhere near the video, the viewership. But what we try to show on the video is the technical how-to do various operations, you know, especially corneal transplant surgeries. I think that a lot of surgical videos nowadays, people try to respect the attention span of the average viewer. Okay. Right. People don't want to watch an hour long video. They want to watch a 4 minute long video, basically. Okay. And so most surgeries are very edited to show the high points of the operation. And the high points of the operation are, well, you were fumbling around with this for 20 minutes and you finally got it to work. So let's clip that 5 seconds of it working. And then you've made a video that's 4.5 minutes long and everything looks amazing and great and wasn't that beautiful. Okay. That is helpful. I like watching those videos, but they're not as helpful as you would hope that they would be, because the stuff that was being tried that wasn't working, the struggles were cut out of the video. Okay. Right. And so I think it is very nice to have videos that are unedited so you can watch exactly what went on from beginning to end. So the struggles weren't omitted. So you can pause them and say, that wasn't working. Don't do that. Okay. So we try to have as many unedited videos as possible so people can see the stuff that I was doing that was not working. So you don't have to make those same mistakes yourself. And kind of in that vein, you know, because our practice is just me and Dad in Birmingham, Alabama, we're not angling for an academic position anywhere. We're not trying to buff our academic CV or something like that. A lot of the stuff that we produce is about vaguely or frankly embarrassing mistakes that we have made. So I write a column called I Wish I Hadn't Done That, which is the idea of a very good friend of mine, Martin DeRozamer. And he's this brilliant cornea surgeon that also trained by Garrett Mellis in Austria. Yeah. And, you know, everybody has got all of these success stories about these heroic eyes that they pulled out of the fire. But everybody's also got these stories of things that seemed like a good idea at the time. And then they did them and they did not work out. And nobody ever says anything about them. They're not in the scientific literature, because if you got a case report of some eye that you screwed up because you did something stupid, well, that's not going to get published. And you don't want to publish it. You don't want to put it on your CV, obviously. You know, so it's lowly regarded scientifically. It's not easy to publish. I mean, in what way does that benefit you academically? But as a result, all of those tar pit ideas, things that seem like they would be a good idea, but are not anywhere to be found in the scientific literature. It's all of these landmine mistakes which have been stepped on before and no one has said anything about it. Okay. So that is the purpose of this column, basically, to point out all of the things that I have done that was not like, oops, my hand slipped, or oops, the patient jerked their head. One of those things that, you know, is a mistake, but not something I can control. These were bad decisions made by me at the time that didn't pan out. And I will say that this column is the most popular thing that I have ever done. You know, you write some scientific article about some new result or new technique. No one cares about that. No one cares, okay? But an article about an eye that you screwed up, everybody is interested in reading about that. So by far, that's been the most successful thing that we have done, that we are liberated to do, because we just have this freedom of being in just this, the two of us in this private practice in Alabama.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, OSHA was one of the originators of showing complications back decades ago. People would only show their cherry-picked cases back on VHS tape in the old days. Yeah. And then he was the one who came with complications, and he was almost shunned. But I'll tell you, it's the best way of learning. He is right. Learning from complications is absolutely the best. And in fact, on Cataract Coach, one of my most favorite subcategories is all the complication videos. And right. I also have another subcategory called complete cataract cases, which are cases of only me operating. So there'll never be a guest editor under complete cataract cases. And then it's all cases that are totally unedited, start to finish, the whole case.
I've watched them. I've watched many of them. And yeah. I learned so much from them. So, I mean, just seeing something you do and think, why is Uday doing that? I mean, you just to try to put yourself in the mind of somebody else and figure out why is something happening. I mean, you just learn so much from that. And the other thing I learned from you, I mean, the videos that you put together, you know, the 4 or 5 minute long videos are amazing. I watch them every day. But these podcasts, you know, I listened to one recently. You had Ed Holland on. I mean, it's just amazing. Riveting, incredible thing to think about these things that these people are doing. I mean, it's just amazing the stuff that you have brought to the world. So thank you so much for doing that incredible work, Uday. I mean, it's just, it is life-changing.
Honestly, I'm a little bit selfish because I learn. I know I'm past age 50, but like even today's conversation, I'm taking notes. I learned.
I got to try. Mostly what not to do. Yeah.
No. But even just how you set up the things in your clinic about the laminar flow device, I got to look this up. I mean, whoa, you can have zero particulate matter? That's better than any operating room.
Yeah, so it's nice. I mean, no filaments or lint or debris or so in the operative site. You know, it's just kind of a nice thing. And another of Garrett Mellis's innovations, you know. I mean, this guy, Garrett Mellis, people think, okay, well, he's the DSET guy or the DMET guy. And he is indeed, you know, but Garrett Mellis, he also invented Tri-Pin Blue. That's, you know, that's why the bottle of Tri-Pin Blue's got the tulip on it, because that was his innovation when he was a resident. He figured out that he can use Tri-Pin Blue. The Surgicube, DSET, DMET, Bowman layer transplantation, that was Garrett Mellis, a variety of intraocular instruments, and nothing is named after him because he's just the most quiet, humble, sweet, generous guy. He has this clinic in Rotterdam, Holland, doesn't have a car, he just has a little bike, and he bikes to work every day. I mean, it's just like there are these incredible people out there that are just humble and quiet and do amazing things, and you can actually call them up and talk to them, which is an amazing thing. It makes it so special to be an ophthalmologist.
Well, that's the beauty of our world. It's a small world. Ophthalmology really is a small world, and we are very collegial and all learn together. It's a neat little family. For sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, Jack, I can't even believe it. We've been chit-chatting for an hour. An hour's gone by already. Can you imagine this? I could probably sit and do another hour here, but I try to keep the podcast at about an hour. But such an amazing time talking to you. I want to thank you again for doing this podcast. It was really enlightening.
It's such an honor. I mean, it really was incredible. I feel weird even actually being asked to be here on the podcast after some of the other people that you've had on here. But what an incredible experience. Thank you, Dave. I always enjoy talking with you and hearing from you.
Awesome. And please send me a couple more of those DMEC videos. We can feature them the day after this podcast airs.
Great.
And we'll all learn together, especially those ones where we learned a good lesson from a complication or what not to do.
I've got plenty.
And I'll remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single Sunday. It's available on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get your podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day. We're at 2,400, coming on 2,500 videos, and we're still doing a new one every day. So until next time, I'll catch you later.